Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, Mama, I'm in fear for my life from the long arm of the law.
Got miles to go before we sleep.
Lawman is putting an end to my running, and I'm so far from my.
We will not go gently. We're going to unleash hell here in December.
Oh, Mama, I can hear you a crying. You're so scared and all alone.
Hey, somebody fix this guy's buckle. I
hey,
you play football.
Coming down from the gallows, and I don't have very long.
Welcome to this installment of What's Hot. I am Brian Giardo, joined as always with Chris Carter. Lots to talk about, and how about What's Hot? It is hot where I'm at in Columbus, Ohio. It Florida with 90 degrees today. I know, Chris, in Pittsburgh, you're feeling that Midwest, East Coast humidity just like I am.
And
I'm really excited to get this show started, buddy. It's been a while since we've talked. A full week has passed. I'm back from California nursing. Some sunburns, unfortunately, but fortunately, if you're a follower of our show, we ended last week's show with some NBA Finals predictions, and I am wrong with my predictions 90% of the time, but I am very happy to say that my Cleveland Cavaliers have a 2-1 lead in the NBA Finals, as I said they would. Before we start talking Steelers, Chris, what are your thoughts about the Finals so far? I kind of tell by the noises you're making on your end of the line.
Well, I'm just upset my prediction didn't come true. But you got to give credit to the way the Cavs are playing. Before this series, there was never an NBA team in NBA Finals history that won a Finals game if they were missing their second and third leading scorers on the team, and they've now done that twice in a row. And Dellavedova's really stepped up, Shumpert's really playing well, and LeBron is just being LeBron. I do think their tough style of defense has gotten the Warriors shooken out of their game. It'll be interesting to see it looks like Curry started to get into his thing late last night, but it was just too little too late. Now the question is, can they step up and overcome in game four so that game five is the 2-2? Because I saw the Warriors leading 2-1 and then the Cavs tying it in game four. But we'll see if they can bounce back. But it's definitely been an exciting series nonetheless.
Right. Going back to last show, I thought the Cavs would win game one. I thought they'd start out strong. Golden State would start slow, wouldn't be able to overcome their slow start. I was almost right. Cavs did come out strong, but Golden State was able to collect themselves and a very efficient end of game four into overtime. And they almost shut out the Cavs there in overtime. I think they outscored either 10-2 or 12-2 there, and the only two was a LeBron layup with 5 seconds left just so he could say that the Cavs scored in the overtime session. Steelers fans, we love our defense. Cavaliers playing great defense. I know a lot of people, NBA fans or whatnot, or just fans of sports in general, don't like to see kind of the slug it out, mucky style of games that you're getting in the NBA finals, but that's what you're getting. And I think Steelers fans can appreciate that, knowing how much we love our defense. And one thing about the finals, we're going to talk about the finals in a multitude of ways here. Also, we're going to introduce a new portion of the show that Chris actually came up with, and I give him mad props. This is going to be something that I think myself, you, and listeners of this podcast are going to enjoy for a while. It's called Select a Steeler. That's kind of a question mark. You can or you can't.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to debate great Steelers from the past along with other Hall of Fame players and Hall of Fame caliber players, and we're going to break down whether we think our Steeler is better or the other player that we're comparing them against. Go ahead, Chris.
The real question is, if you're a GM in today's NFL and you have a chance to draft either of these players, you need this position, and, it's not – forget about the rest part of the team. Each matchup is going to be a corner versus a corner or a running back versus a running back, and it's going to be who would you take, knowing their successes that they had in the NFL, their measurables, their speed, their athleticism? Who would you take over? Would you take a legendary Steeler or a comparable legendary NFL player from another team? And you know, it's going to be bringing up interesting conversations, and they can be from different eras, but it's about who can play in today's NFL. So that's the gist of it.
Right, and I promise you, we will differ. I know Chris and I normally tend to agree, which is nice when 90% of the time when you're broadcasting together. But in debate, you got to mix up a little bit. So I will always go on the opposite end of what Chris says, and vice versa, just to make sure that it's colorful, good debate. And tonight I'll give it away. We're going to debate primetime Neon Deion Sanders, the cornerback and wide receiver, Dallas Cowboys, 49ers. And the Atlanta Falcons, also played some baseball for the Braves and New York Yankees, against our Rod Woodson. Rod played, I think, an 18-year NFL career, 10 of those with the Steelers, 75th all-NFL anniversary team, 71 career interceptions. So that's going to be the debate. If you want to call on this show to give us your 2 cents on why Rod Woodson, you'd pick him over Deion Sanders or vice versa. I'm assuming this being our podcast, most people are going to go with Rod Woodson there. Call in the show. Call in at 347-850-8181. Again, we encourage you to call in the show at any time during this hour, 347-850-8181. We'll also break down the Steelers offense. An article on Behind the Steel Curtain came out earlier this week about whether or not Steelers fans should be concerned with the red zone offense. Todd Haley, the Steelers OC, opened up about that, among some other things. Looking ahead to the Steelers offense, that's something we will break down as well. But without further ado, let's discuss the NBA Finals again. And Cleveland fans always want a reason to boo the Steelers, and especially Ben Roethlisberger, where, if you remember, Ben is from the Findlay, Ohio area. So and he's only once lost to Cleveland. Actually, twice. He's only lost to Cleveland once or twice. I can't recall if he started in 09, or 13, rather. He has an almost a perfect record against Cleveland in Cleveland. In general, he's had tons of success against the Ohio teams, Bengals and Browns, in his career. The state he was born in, the Buckeye State. But during the NBA Finals, who did they play? My goodness. Golden State was shooting free throws. And the Jumbotron, I got so much on my mind here, so much to discuss on this show, I'm losing my train of thought here. But Golden State was at the line shooting free throws, and the Jumbotron showed a picture of Ben Roethlisberger, which led to a cascading shower of boos, and ABC actually caught this during Game 3. And that was, again, another article on BTSC. You know, I go to Cavs games, and they do that every game, and it kind of was funny that, in the NBA Finals, of all the games, they decided, the ESPN ABC crew decided to pick up on it. I guess talk about that, Chris, and how it's funny that even in the NBA Finals, there's still some sort of Steeler connection.
Yep, it's fun. But it's good. It's the ever thing about Cleveland. We are always on Cleveland's mind. The Cleveland Indians that we play, and if you wear Steelers gear, it's a problem. It's something that I've experienced. I've talked to Browns fans and friendly Browns fans. They're just joking, but it's every time we hate the Steelers. In my experience, I don't hate the Browns. They annoy me sometimes because they always talk and they always talk. But since I've been alive, the Browns have been kind of kicked around, and this is the second rendition of the Browns. You aren't even the real original Cleveland Browns. Your organization was brought here because your other organization didn't like you enough and left. So there's a lot of hatred. The Steelers kick around the Browns. It seems like every year, once in a while, they beat the Steelers. They beat them the last time we played when we were in Cleveland this past season, and they played, and their defense was really tough, but. But when you look at the history, how many times has Ben lost them? Maybe three times?
Twice. He's lost three times overall and twice in Cleveland. Yeah, he didn't play in the 2012 game, but 2009, I think it was, on the Thursday night football game. So that's his only loss there. So, but yeah, you're right. They very seldom lose there. Yeah, so.
Yeah, it's one of those things. And think about it. It's your division rival. They're always winning Super Bowls. You haven't won any Super Bowls. Your titles go back before the Super Bowl. It wasn't even a thing. And they're kicking you around, and they don't even they don't even respect you. Of course they're going to hate you. So you put Ben Roethlisberger up there, who's beaten, only lost twice in his what, over 10 years he's been in the league now. He only lost twice, and he plays them twice a year. Oh, yeah, I understand their hatred of us. But you know what? It comes with being great when you have 6 Super Bowls. It's going to happen. So it doesn't surprise me, but it does make me laugh. It's like, wow, ha, rough to be a Cleveland fan.
It's funny, Chris, because a lot of people say, how can you be, for me, how can you be a Pittsburgh fan and everything, but then cheer for the Cavs? And for me, the answer is always easy. You know, there's no, NBA team in Pittsburgh, and then Cleveland is the closest team to me. I was born in Ohio, still live here. So, the it was an easy choice. But it is weird when you're up there. And again, if you go to a Pirate game, 90% has kind of been my go-to so far on this show. I don't know why, but, 90% or more of Pirate fans are also Steeler fans. So, if you just mentioned in passing, did you hear about Tynes Ward holding out back in 2005? I remember I was at a Pirate game, and that was the conversation. Oh, yeah, you go to a Penguin game, you can say, man, how you did the Pirates renew this year, and people will know what you're talking about. And that's always funny when I'm in Cleveland and I'll be at a Cavs game, and the fan next to me will mention the Browns, and I'll be like, well, I'm actually kind of a Steeler fan, or I am a Steeler fan. So then there's this, oh, man, and all this back and forth. It's funny. It's not like the cross teams, the cross cities. It's the thing. It's the cultural differences and similarities about both. And the thing I like about both is just how just insanely passionate they are about their teams winning. It's not just about, like, Chicago, obviously they want the Cubs to win, but if they don't, it's not the end of the world because they're used to them not winning. I mean, let's be frank. They're not accepting of the losing. Cubs fans, it's not like they just go and they're just whatever, we'll never win. I mean, they're optimistic, just like Browns and Steelers fans are, but for us, it's just like optimism isn't enough. And being disappointed, we expect and demand excellence. And that's the thing that separates Cleveland and Pittsburgh. While we have the titles, our fan faith has been rewarded with championships. Cleveland's hasn't, but that hasn't shaken their resolve. One thing that kind of surprised me when you look at the Cleveland fan base, though, is that the Indians don't sell well at all. And in the 90s, they had a record for consecutive sellouts that spanned, I think, about half a decade of consecutive sellouts. Yeah. So maybe they're jaded by their World Series losses, I don't know. And on the flip side of that, the Pirates went through that in the 90s where, and 6-7 years ago, it was hard to get fans to go to PNC Park just because fans had just, they didn't want to accept losing, maybe like Cubs fans, but they stopped going. Cubs fans will still show up even if the team stinks. Pittsburghers and Clevelanders aren't like that. If you're not winning and there's no hope, we're not going to lose, faith in you guys. We're just not going to show up anymore and pay for a bad product. And I think that's kind of the difference. And in that is the next topic I wanted to discuss with you, Chris, is LeBron James. A lot of people like to compare him to Michael Jordan. And for a long time, I've wanted to write a story, Chris, comparing him to Joe Green from the standpoint that, Cleveland basketball was kind of in the pits when, before LeBron got there. They had made the playoffs a couple times. They even made an Eastern Conference Finals in the 90s against the Bulls. But really, mostly it was just kind of a murky existence. More losing than winning, much more losing than winning. And they were, they were the worst team in the league when LeBron came there in 2003. Very similar to Joe Green, where, as Chris, the Steelers had pretty much no history of winning the first 35 years of existence. Then Joe Green comes to town. And all of a sudden, just the whole culture changes. The only difference is LeBron left to learn how to win titles, and Joe Green never left. Even though, as you know, I'll let you tell the story, Chris, Joe Green actually almost did leave the Steelers in 74.
Well, Joe Green was getting frustrated. He wanted to win championships. He was a stubborn individual. He always said what was on his mind. He never hid away from a conflict. That was not his style. So, yeah, right. So I would say that if you were to compare LeBron James to Joe Green, that's an out there comparison. I would say that they're catalysts in the sense that they started something. They changed something because the Cavaliers were a joke before LeBron. He made them contenders. Then when he left, they didn't like him anymore. Joe Green, when he came, he was a huge part of making the Steelers a contender. But I'd say one of the things of comparing football to basketball, LeBron James can come to Cleveland and make them, title contenders. But Joe Green you know, he could have came to when he came to Pittsburgh, if he didn't get Terry Bradshaw, Mel Blount, Franco Harris, Lin Swan Johnstall, Jack Lambert, if he didn't get all these other all-stars, it would not have been, he would not have carried that team to a level six. So it's different, but I do agree in the sense that LeBron is a catalyst of bringing greatness to teams in basketball. So I think that's where I see the comparison. But I still would list, if I was to list all-time great athletes, Joe Green goes above LeBron James. Sorry.
No, and I agree with you. I agree with you. But and the other thing that I know that you know about Chris, because we've discussed on previous shows, especially, you know, most people didn't know until recently that Joe Green played more than half his career with injuries to his, you know, one of his arms and shoulders where he lost feeling. You know, that really kind of made him more mortal. But the first half of his career, he was a freak of nature. And it's funny when, you know, that's the same thing that you hear Andy Russell and John Kolb and you know, his other teammates and people who played against him and coaches and whatnot back in the early 70s, what they said about Joe Green is the same things people say about LeBron now, is that he just is just this freak of nature. And that's the story I've always wanted to write, is that LeBron is kind of the modern-day Joe Green from the standpoint that he's just, nobody saw a sheer force like Joe Green before, someone that had so much speed for his size, that closing speed, and just his ability to just shed off double teams, triple teams. He revolutionized the game with his stunt 4-3, just because it's kind of how LeBron's revolutionized the game. Now in the NBA, where he can play all five positions at a high level. He's not just like, oh, I can fill in and play center. He can play them all. And, you know, Joe Green could have been a linebacker. He was so nimble and quick on his feet. He was so good as a lineman. Why would you have to move him back there? Plus, we were so good at linebacker anyways. So I guess that's the main comparison to me, is just their freakish ability. And you know, when I think about Joe Green, and I want to make this point, then I'll let you kind of finish up this topic, Chris. When I think of Joe Green, I don't think of, and I think a lot of Steeler fans are this way, they think of kind of the Joe Green near the end of the run, kind of the captain, kind of like Papa Joe Green, kind of, you know, with his influence, and the other guys kind of did all the great, you know, he kind of led the other guys to the greatness, kind of like, you know, Super Bowl 13 and 14, he wasn't the Joe Green of old, but he was still, you know, an impact player that could play at a high level, but it was more just, he was just the captain of the team. He just kind of led by example, and that's kind of what I see with LeBron now. He's 30, which in basketball terms is actually kind of old, especially for somebody that can still play that high of a level. But mainly now, I think as he gets older, he'll remind me more of Joe Green from the standpoint that the guys will play hard for him, almost like he's a coach, and they don't want to let him down, and really he just needs to lead by example. And that's what Joe Green, to me, did a lot near the end of his career. He just led by example. I think that's what led to those Super Bowl wins. And I think Joe Green made as much of an impact on the team from a leadership standpoint than he ever did from a talent standpoint, because I think he was the Chuck Knoll of the players, pretty much like they had a head coach on the field kind of directing the leadership and all of those things.
Gotcha. I agree that there's definitely leadership on both sides. And you're seeing right now LeBron James is making people play better in Cleveland. He didn't do that as much in Miami. I think that they assembled really great players. You had Dwayne Wade, you had Chris Bosh, you had Ray Allen. You know, Dame Jones has seems to follow him everywhere he goes and keep getting rings. I'd say that they both made people play better around them, and Joe Green, that's a big thing that he did. He stayed there for a long time. So Joe Green's legacy as a player is done, but we have yet to see how LeBron's the second half of his career will play out.
Right. And the last thing I want to say about LeBron is, as he's gotten older, he's gotten better, which reminds me of Terry Bradshaw, where I compared, you know, we compared LeBron to Joe Green. But, you know, I think one thing, you know, with Terry Bradshaw, the first half of it, I mean, sometimes athletes get better late 20s, early 30s. A lot of times we think, okay, you know, when an athlete reaches his athletic peak physically, then that's the apex and prime of his career. And sometimes, especially for a position where you have to think a lot, that's not necessarily the case. And I think case in point with Bradshaw is that the first half of his career, heck, I mean, his fifth season in the league, he was fighting to beat Terry Henry for the starting quarterback position. Terry Henry had more interceptions than completed passes in one of the Steelers' regular season wins against the Browns in 74. If not for the Steelers returning a fumble for a touchdown, the Steelers probably don't win. And Franco being great, the Steelers don't win that game. But later in Terry's career, once he hit 30, 31 years old, he started to possess the mental game, and he had, you know, the plays down. He had the players, you know, he had their trust, and then he just went out and got it done. And I think that's the thing you're seeing with LeBron now. And I think that's one thing about Terry Bradshaw that really stinks, that when you talk about the greatest quarterback of all time conversation, I think there's two main reasons why his name doesn't come up more. A, because of the stats, because A, he struggled the first half of his career, as we mentioned, and B, that was a different era, and the Steelers had one of the best rushing attacks in NFL history, led by Franco and Rocky. But, you know, B, you know, he was always kind of labeled as kind of a system quarterback that had all that great talent. But to me, you know, and I know you agree, this is rocket science. Without Bradshaw, they don't win those Super Bowls. So, you know, to me, you know, and Terry's just the example of someone that, you know, later in his career, when you put your mental game and your physical game together, like he did those last two Super Bowl years, it's really a remarkable thing to watch, because his mental game finally caught up to his athletic game. And Bradshaw was the complete package in 78, 79. I mean, you know, you can say that Montana and that Brady and all those guys were better, but for 2 years, I don't know if there's any other – I probably wouldn't take any other quarterback than Terry Bradshaw. And I still think his 78 season stands up there with any other quarterbacks as the greatest single season for a passer in league history.
It's certainly up there, and it's one of the reasons that I still think Terry Bradshaw is one of the greatest of all time.
Yeah. And also, too, again, we encourage people to call into the show, 347-850-8181. Again, that's 347-850-8181. Also, you can follow us on Twitter, B as in Boy, T as in Tommy, and then Steel Curtain, B-T, Steel Curtain. And Danny Bosick, a contributor to the show, has been good enough to actually give us live tweet updates, give you guys live tweet updates about what we're discussing during the podcast. So thanks, Danny, for your work, and read her stuff. She's a very interesting writer. She's really entertaining. I really like reading her stuff. So moving ahead, Chris, on the show, wanted to talk about another topic. This is current Steeler related, since the show is titled What's Hot. Todd Haley did speak to the media earlier this week about some things regarding the Steelers offense. And while they did rank pretty high in the NFL last season in red zone efficiency, Haley was quoted to say that the Steelers left 30 to 35 points on the pretty much out there in space halfway through the season. You know, he really wasn't liking or just thought that the Steelers' red zone offense could be more efficient. I want to know your thoughts on that, and if Steelers fans should be worried going into the 2015 season about their red zone offense.
Well, when you look at red zone offense, it has been a major problem for the Steelers for a while. I think our offense is explosive, and so we are able to put up a lot of points and get a lot of yards. But one of the biggest things is we always seem to break down, whether it's our line doesn't make the key blocks, or we are too predictable, it seems to be a problem. I think this year, when they say that we had a 51.72 percentage on red zone efficiency in 2014, and that was down from 52.83% in 2013, and that put us at 19th in the league. Now, a big part of that was early in the season; it was extremely low, and I think it picked up, you know, towards the later part of the season. But red zone efficiency has been a major problem for this offense, where we can drive, we can get the ball. When it comes down to making those key decisions, to making those big plays, then we gotta when we're making those big plays, then we gotta make more clutch plays in tighter spaces, because it's, you know, the defense, if they're playing bend but don't break, which happens a lot in today's NFL with the high powered offenses and the rules to bring back defenders, the red zone is where you have to execute. And, you know, New England, that's something that they've done very well over the years. When they get in the red zone, there's a good chance that they're gonna score. So it's something that we really need to work on. I think Todd Haley knows that. He said that last season as well. When you look at we ranked 19th, and they know that. But they know that we have to use more weapons. You saw in the Texans game when Antonio Brown had they threw a reverse to him, and he threw it to Lance Moore. That was I think it was one of their attempts to be more innovative.
It was a great
plays.
Example, by the way.
Yeah, it's how you create plays in the red zone. Also, just a reminder that the number is 347-850-8581. We mixed it up a little bit on one of the posts, but 347-850-8581. If you are listening, you want to chime in about the Steelers and their red zone offense. But yeah, Brian, it's something that I've been frustrated. It's something I've been frustrated with Ben for the longest time. It seems to be a problem. And there's been games where he can make the right plays, and there's games where he doesn't make the right plays. And often I've seen the problem with the Steelers' offense. You know, the offensive line in the past has been a problem, but lately his consistency. You saw in the Jets game, you even saw in the Bucs game where he threw some touchdowns late in the game. They needed one first down, and he couldn't. He wasn't able to lead the offense to do that. And that's what I want to see him do to be the best in the league, is take over, take charge, and you know, be that guy that, you know, he's passionate. He wants to improve that red zone percentage, and we need our red zone percentage up towards 70. If you can get it up towards there, then we're going to be putting more points because we can move the ball. We know we can move the ball. Our offensive line is young and strong. We got receivers everywhere that are flying all over the place. You know, and we have running back. We have one of the best running backs in the league in Bell. You got this new guy, D'Angelo Williams, and if Dre Archer can get going. I mean, it starts with Ben Roethlisberger. It starts with offensive line, really. But the key to improving in the red zone, it starts with Ben Roethlisberger reading the defense, knowing what's coming, being able to see the pre-snap, and then making the correct decision to get into the end zone. And it's going to take other people to execute as well. But I see this is a Ben thing that he has to work on. And Haley can call different plays. He can call every play he wants to call. But if Ben doesn't read stuff pre-snap and make better decisions, it's going to be rougher in the red zone. But I do see that changing this year, because I do think we're also going to have an added boost with the ground game. I think that the offensive line is going to be more in sync, and Ben's going to be able to say, I think we can win this ground war right here in a cloud of dust and get 3 yards and put it in the end zone. But what's your problem? What do you see as one of the main issues why we struggle in the red zone? And it's been a thing for a while. It isn't something new. Why do you see that, Brian?
It comes down to three things for me. Obviously, you know, what Ben's decision-making. Because one thing that you think about with Ben, and again, this is no shock to anybody that follows the team, is that Ben likes to – he's a great ad-libber, and he does a great job, you know, when he's under duress and when plays kind of break down. Well, in the red zone, a lot of times, the defensive line, the linebackers, you're not putting a lot of pressure on the quarterback. You're kind of playing back because you're more in that condensed space. So a lot of times, you know, Ben's in a three-step drop, and he's just got to make a decision, and he doesn't have to rely on the – you know, a lot of times, as I just said, a play breaks down, the receiver gets open, Ben elongates the play and hits the guy deep down the field. Well, he's not getting those situations in a red zone. Nobody's going to escape the attention of a secondary, unless they're a really bad secondary, when, you know, you're at the 10-yard line. It's like somebody's going to break open down the field because you're only 10 yards away. So I think a lot of it is finding good plays on a three-step drop that Ben can execute. And a lot of that, and this is the second point, is getting receivers to get open. I think the biggest issue from why we were in the bottom half of the league last year in red zone efficiency was because we didn't have a good slot receiver last year, a reliable one. I mean, Lance was injured. Darius Hayward-Bey is a special teams guy. He had problems getting onto the field as a receiver. And that left Marcus Wheaton, who was in his second year, still kind of learning how to do the job, and Antonio Brown, who you know is going to get the attention of the other team's best cornerback, and in a lot of situations, he's going to get double-teamed. It also doesn't, you know, help Antonio that he's not really tall. Enter Martavis Bryant, if he matures and becomes more – and I think to me, Chris, and we've had this conversation, I think he's the wild card of this team, because I think if Martavis, you know, with what he – this is what made Plexico great. Plexico could do two things for us. He was not really a great route runner. He did make some nice third and 12s over the middle, but not all the time. His – why we wrote checks for him was he could catch the deep ball and the jump ball when we got in the red zone. I mean, you remember that New England game in 04 that, you know, we snapped New England's 21 game winning streak, which is still an NFL record. You know, Ben just took a quick snap in the red zone and not much thinking on his part, just lofted a nice jump ball to the 6'4", 6'5" Burris, and he was able to snare it down over his smaller defensive back that was giving up 5 or 6 inches at least to Burris. And I think with Martavis, that's the next step is, okay, we know you're a deep ball threat. We know you can stretch the field and get down there and make big plays, a la the Cincinnati game. That was one of the backbreaking scores that we had in that game. But can you provide that for us in the red zone? Can you make the tough, you know, red zone catch? And ditto goes to Wheaton. And I think that's what made the 95 Steelers so good is because, and the 05 Steelers, because Randall L. was the epitome of that. He would just make really nice plays in space. He wasn't a game breaker. He wasn't a deep ball threat. He deep caught some, but really, Randall L., whether it was a bubble screen and or whatnot, he could do that. And that's what made Santonio great. That's what Wallace never became, but that's what made Santonio great was he could get open in the red zone and do so many things. So I think that's a big thing. And I think the last thing is, you know, obviously Todd Haley making more creative calls. That's one thing where you could say what you want about Bruce Arians. And I think where Ben's at his career, I think obviously it was criticized quite a bit 3 years ago. But I think a lot of Steelers fans would say they're happy now with the job that Todd Haley's done. But he's not as creative in the red zone as Bruce Arians was. He's just not. Bruce Arians was a master at demising really nice red zone plays. And he didn't have some of those years the talent that Todd has now. So that's kind of the next step for Todd and this Steelers offense. They've gotten better every single season. And then last season was kind of their breakout year. But if they're going to get better, they have to work on the creativity in the red zone. And again, as you said, Chris, a lot of that comes down to the players executing the plays. The last point I wanted to make, I'll give it back to you here, is the running game. You know, the Steelers don't have Jerome Bettis anymore. That's what made the red zone as potent as it was late 90s, 2000s, 2004, especially in 05. You know, third down, two, third and three, you can give it to Bettis. I'm not saying Le'Veon Bell is not a between-the-tackle back, but he's better on the outside. He's better on counterplay. So we have to develop, whether it's a trap play, something, to develop something in the red zone that can make us a threat running the football. Because, again, that's what made Franco great. That's what made Dan Morris for two seasons and Barry Foster for a few seasons, what made us so potent running the football. Obviously, you know, Jerome Bettis, that's why his yards per carry average wasn't great. He got the ball a lot on third and three, and he gained 4 yards. Or, you know, fourth and two, and he gained 3 yards. So that's, you know, or, you know, third and goal at the three, Bettis would score. It's hard to have a 4.0 yards per carry average when you're getting the ball at the 3 yard line. So that's what made Bettis so great. And I think those are some things that are going to make our offense better. And I think it will get better. We're not going into the season with so many question marks at wide receiver. I mean, we do have some, but they're good question marks. You know, God, what are we going to do with all this depth at receiver? That's kind of the question, not who's going to play receiver for us. So, I don't think all of the negativity or worry surrounding our red zone offense next year are warranted. I think we're going to be fine.
Well, funny that you mention it. The best year that we've had, I believe, is since 2003 when, you know, red zone scoring percentage was recorded by I'm looking on teamrankings.com, and the highest percentage that we've had, at least that I can see, is in 2005 when we had a 62.5% success rate in touchdowns. But every other year, even in 2004 when we were 15-1, you know, we were under 50% in the red zone. 2010 when we went to the Super Bowl, we ranked in the at 15, which was better, you know, than most. You know, we ranked in the top half of the league, 52.46%. But it's something that we seem to struggle with. And you're right, not having the big back, because Bettis, I mean, he was the guy that you gave it to all the time in those clutch situations. In 2008, of course, in the Super Bowl, we had a little bit better as well. But you don't even need a Jerome Bettis. You need a guy who's going to hit the hole, do what he has to do to get in the end zone. Someone whose will is, you know, unstoppable. He's going to come in there and he can just take over and know I'm getting in the end zone. And that's a big thing. But I think also comes with it, you know, when you don't have that Jerome Bettis, you need to be able to be successful. The New England Patriots all this season, they flipped running back faster than any team I've ever seen, but their offense was still going to score if it was in the red zone, and part of that quick decision making that you were talking about. So it's going to have to improve. But, you know, Ben's going through individual drills of people. He seems to be learning everybody's position even more than he already knew. So who knows? Maybe that's what we're in store for in 2015.
Right, right. And I hope you're right there. You know, and again, that it's a feeling out process. And I feel like with Ben, you know, and that's today really in the NFL with free agency and whatnot, salary caps, is that you don't have those years and years of years of just knowing your teammates. You know, Bradshaw, a lot of times, he just had a feeling that Franco needed the ball. Okay, let's call a trap play, those kind of things. And that's where sometimes I'm not opposed, and this is where Ben gets a little older, and him and Todd's relationship matures more. You know, Terry called his own plays, and I think a lot of times in the red zone that worked out. And hopefully Ben will have more say over what plays are called in the red zone. And I know the Steelers have done more hurry up recently, especially last year. They did it on occasion and had a lot of success. So hopefully they can do more of that this year. And, you know, when you talk about Tom Brady and Montana and those guys, I think that's really what separates them from the rest of the pack is that those guys in large, I don't have any of those stats really in front of me, but just off memory, you know, and watching them and normally disliking what they're doing to the expense of the Steelers, those guys just finished drives. They executed. And a lot of that was coaching and, you know, Belichick putting Brady's teammates in position that Brady could find them on easy plays. I mean, this is a name that maybe some of you guys forgot about, but I know as soon as I say it, you'll know what I'm talking about, and that's Kevin Faulk. Tom Brady had Kevin Faulk during, you know, the three Super Bowl runs in 4 years. I think, honestly, you look at that Matt Light on the offensive line, and then you look at Tom Brady. Other than that, I think when they had that three-year Super Bowl run in 4 years in the early 2000s, Kevin Faulk was one of the more important offensive players on that team. He caught so many screen passes, especially against us in big games, slant passes. He was just that X factor that made life for Tom Brady so easy, because when they would spread the field, and they have Deion Branch out there, they have Ernest Givens out there, David Givens, excuse me, you know, Faulk would just kind of glide out there near the sideline, and Brady would hit him so many times. And that's where Ben, maybe D'Angelo Williams can be the guy, because Le'Veon Bell's not going to sneak up on anybody like Kevin Faulk would, and he's not. You know, and again, I don't think he's going to have 80 catches again in his career. I just think he's too valuable as a receiver, and we can't keep, you know, regulating into those kind of hits. So, you know, hopefully that's D'Angelo Williams. But again, a lot of that is providing Ben with easy options, easy outlets if his receivers recover. But I think, again, the biggest thing comes down to what his receivers are able to do. And a name that we haven't really discussed at all is Jesse James. He's the new fifth-round pick out of Penn State. He had a lot of nice red zone catches as a tight end at Penn State. Again, you know, he's going to be, you know, you might fight with Matt Spaeth for the backup position, but who knows? Maybe you put him out there with Heath Miller in the slot, and you put, you know, Martavis Bryant out there, and then you put Antonio Brown out there. And again, we have no idea what Sammy Coates can do. I think there's so many options on this offense that we're going to be immensely better than we were last year. I think it comes down to a couple of things: their maturity individually and their rap sheet and their rapport with Roethlisberger and getting on the same page. But I know you agree with me, Chris. You look at the Steelers' schedule, the hardest in the NFL this season going in. We're not going to beat Seattle with a mediocre red zone. We're not going to beat New England with a mediocre red zone. You know, we can't. And that's what killed us against Denver in the 2011 playoffs. I know that was a while ago, and Bruce was our OC. But I think we had, a 9-0 lead in that game, or a 6-0 lead. We settled for – it was 6-0. We settled for field goals. We kicked their butt in the first quarter of that game. We had two long drives. It could have been 14-0 easily. It was 6-0. And then Tim Tebow scores before you know it, you're down 7-6. And it was a
difficult game. It's
different.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it's all about finishing
it. And football, just like basketball, it's a lot about momentum.
Mm-hmm.
So
I agree. You're looking at a guy, you're talking to a guy, you know, looking at me because we are in a different state. But you are talking to a guy who has always observed this and said that is our number one flaw in offense. We do not finish the job, and that's something that we have to do better in 2015. And you know, whoever's going to be that finisher, whether it's going to be Roethlisberger, whether it could be Martavis Bryant, because also you saw the red zone and percentage improve when he was added to the offense after the Texans game. He gives Ben a height option. He's someone that defenses have. He might have, he might throw a fade route to that guy. He's pretty tall. We might have to put, you know, a safety over there to think about that. And that alone, just making defenses have to respect that. Now they can't just focus it on Antonio Brown or Heath Miller or even Le'Veon Bell. And so now, again, that's where the multiple weapons will come into play. And I do think we will see. I'm saying you can debate this with me if you want. I'm saying we have a better than 60. I'll say I'm going to go and be bold. We're going to have better than a 62% red zone percentage for touchdowns. Which would put us in the top five of all red zone efficiency offenses in the league.
Right, and kind of last point before we go to our I'm happy we're going to have about 20 minutes to discuss this. I'm very excited. And again, too, I gave you the wrong phone number earlier. I apologize. If you want to call into the show in the last third of the show, call in at 347-851-8151. Again, that's 347-850-8151 to discuss between Rod Woodson and Deion Sanders. If you were a GM, which one would you acquire? And, yeah, you know, kind of last point on the red zone offense, you know, I just think, you know, the backup running back to me, and not even DeAndre, I know he'll produce, but it's a question of how efficient in the red zone. Can he be – and that's what, you know, and I've said before, you know, I'm a Steelers fan, and this is not – I think at the end of the show, people are going to be calling me a closet Cowboys fan, which I'm going to hate, but especially as we discussed the Deion Rod Woodson thing. But, you know, that's what made the 90s Cowboys so good, was that when they got down in the red zone, they had that mammoth offensive line that was nicknamed the Great Wall of Dallas, and they had Moose Johnson blocking for Emmitt Smith. That's what made them great. They closed the deal, and that's what I hope the Steelers can find on offense next year. I mean, wide receivers, the questions will be answered. Each guy will find their role. You know, Bryant will be the Plexico Burress. Brown will be Brown. Heath will be Heath. I think Jesse James will add in an added wrinkle to the team, along with Spaeth continuing his small contribution, especially more blocking with Spaeth, but the question is going to be, in Bell's absence, and even when Bell comes back, can we add a power element of running prowess to our red zone offense? I think that's going to be one of the biggest keys. But moving ahead to our final topic, I cannot wait. And again, this was Chris's baby. I'm not going to take any credit for this. However, I'm glad that you brought it to the show. When I was out in California this week on vacation, Chris sent me an email, and when I was on the beach, in between celebrating Cavs playoff victories and spending way too much money out there in California, I looked at an email Chris sent me with a topic titled Select the Steeler, and it had all these matchups of Steeler greats of the past against other NFL greats of the past that didn't play for us. And the comparisons and the list are awesome. I mean, I'm not going to give away one, but, you know, one, well, I am, I guess. Bo Jackson was on the list of one guy that I remember offhand that we're going to debate later on against the current our former Steeler great. There's so many options here. And the first one that we're going to do, and again, as Chris said earlier on the show, if you're a general manager, which one of these guys do you want on your team today, to play on your team today? We've got Rod Woodson on one side for the Steelers, and on the other side, we've got Michael Irvin. And from there, Chris, I'll kind of let you discuss their bios, and if you want to go ahead and make your pick, go ahead and make your pick, and I'll counter.
Let's break it down and look at these guys' measurables. Sanders was a little bit taller than Woodson, 6'1", but not as stocky. He had 189 pounds. Woodson was 6 foot, 205 pounds. And Sanders, both were blazingly fast. Both ran sub 4.3 times. Sanders ran a 4.27 as it was recorded, and Woodson ran a 4.28. Sanders is regarded as one of the greatest cover corners in the history of the NFL, and rightfully so. He has 53 interceptions, 22 total touchdowns. He wasn't much of a tackler, but that was just how great he was. Teams, you know, he made 8 Pro Bowls and was 6 times first team All Pro, just off of his covering skills. He only had 1 sack and 493 tackles in his career. And when you look at Woodson, he had 1,163 tackles. So he had a lot more, though. He played, you know, I think he played more years than Deion. But you're looking at a guy who he dominated just off of his cover skills alone. And that's what most people, when you talk about this debate, when you talk about this, you're going to look and say, okay, Deion's got the coverage, but does Rod, does his other, as Lance would say on our standards, does he have the intangibles to outmatch that? Because Rod came up and made tackles. Rod was more physical with you. And Rod actually has more interceptions than Deion in his career. Rod had 71 total interceptions. And in those interceptions, you saw him use his feet often. He had 13.5 sacks, and like I said, he had over 1,100 tackles. So, in my opinion, you got a guy. Sanders also was part of the back-to-back Super Bowl champion Dallas Cowboys in 29 and 30 when they beat our Pittsburgh Steelers, and Rod Woodson was there. But and one thing we also want to talk about is when you talk about this debate, talk about their major achievements in big plays that they made or big statements that they had. And Rod Woodson, one of the things that you got to note and how much of an athlete this was, this man tore his ACL in the season of Super Bowl 30. and he was able to come back in time for the Super Bowl after tearing his ACL and cover Michael Irvin. He was that guy. He was such a warrior. And when you everyone remembers when he was covering Michael Irvin and he makes the big swat and then he points to his knee and shakes his head like no, I'm here for that. So I'm selecting the Steelers. I'm rolling with the Rooneys. I'm sticking with Rod Woodson as my guy. He may not have the prime time profile. He may not have the face that everyone likes to put on CBS. And you know, he ended up at Swiss. But you know what, brother, smooth. He worked real hard. He got 71 interceptions. He's one of the greatest players of all time. And I'm going with him. And again, I'm a homer, so people can say, "Oh, you're crazy, Chris." But you know, we're looking. I'm looking at Twitter right now, and I'm pulling up the comments on our website because we posted about this. And so far, a lot of people are going Woodson. But before we go through those comments, Brian, what are your thoughts on these two legendary defenders?
I think the crazy thing about Rod is that at 89, he was the best kickoff return man in the NFL. He averaged 27.3 yards to kickoff return, which was best in the league that year. He also made the Pro Bowl as a cornerback. So, you know, if you're a general manager and you're looking at a guy that can help you on special teams field position and then taking away a third of the field as a corner, you're going to go Rod Woodson because he could take away, you know, special teams. You're getting an upgrade. Your offense is going to start, let's say, you know, Rod gets a kickoff at the 5-yard line, your offense is going to have the ball at the 32-yard line. He also returned a kickoff for a score that year. He also returned 2 punt returns for touchdowns in his career. He's second all-time and was first for a long time in, total touchdowns, interception returns. So I think Ed Reed, you know, passed him. So, which, you know, Ed Reed passing anything is not a lean feat. So when you look at those things, Rod Woodson had an impeccable career. When you look at the fact that he made the Pro Bowl, he was an all-pro as a 37-year-old for the Raiders in 2002. That's unbelievable. Mm-hmm. When you look at, he was able to switch to a safety the second half of his career after. He really had two careers. He had his, he had his career with the Steelers, and then he had his career, you know, with the Niners, the Ravens, where he won a Super Bowl on that legendary 2000 Raven defense where he led the Ravens in interceptions. And then you look at, you know, what he's able to do with the Raiders at the very end of his career, helping them get to the Super Bowl. I mean, Rod's longevity just shows you the kind of athlete he was, that he could play, not just be a guy that played in the NFL. He was one of the best in his positions at age 37. Prime, he was still helping teams get to a Super Bowl. With that being said, if I'm a general manager and I'm looking at a guy that can help my team win in the biggest way, I'm going Deion Sanders. Mm-hmm. And the reason why is, to your point, you know, in the 90s, in the mid-90s, there was two teams pretty much fighting to go to the Super Bowl and win it, and that was the Cowboys and the 49ers. You know, 92, 93, and 94, they met in the NFC Championship game, and each year the winner of that game decided who won the Super Bowl. The 49ers lost to Dallas 2 years in a row. They felt that paying Deion Sanders, who was with the Falcons at that time, paying him to come to San Francisco for 1 year was worth it, and that's what got them over the hump. He totally dominated Michael Irvin in the 94 NFC title game, and that was a huge reason why the Niners went to the Super Bowl that year, and they won it, and he had an interception in that Super Bowl, and that's the last time the Niners won the Super Bowl. He was the 94 NFL Defensive Player of the Year in his one season with the Niners. He had 6 interceptions, and of those 6 interceptions, he had over 300 interception return yards and 3 touchdowns. So that, I'm a general manager. I'm not just looking at what you can do getting interceptions, but what do you do when the ball's in your hands? That he was unreal at making interceptions and turning them into these big games and doing that. Deion Dance, I wasn't a fan of, but I digress. Then, you know, the very next year, the Cowboys said, okay, well, we need this guy. So they signed Deion, took him away from the Niners, and guess what? Dallas won the Super Bowl the next year. Deion didn't have as big of an impact with his interceptions. He was kind of injured that season. But Jerry Jones let him play wide receiver. He had a huge catch in the NFC title game, which led to a pivotal touchdown by Emmitt Smith to help them distance themselves from the Packers. He had a 47-yard catch over Willie Williams that helped Cowboys score early in Super Bowl 30. So, you know, again, when you're a general manager and you're looking at how to upgrade your team, Rod could help you from special teams and defense. Deion could help you with defense and offense. I don't know how, and he wasn't just a, a, a serviceable receiver. Deion was a good receiver. He was a good slot receiver. He was a good – he could be a second receiver on a bad team. He could be a three receiver on a very good team, which that's what he was with the Cowboys. He was their number three receiver on the 95 team that won the Super Bowl, and he was also just their best defensive player at the same time. They had other good defensive players like Charles Haley,
so
who's going to be in the Hall of Fame
gonna,
this year
with
Bettis.
You're going to go with Neon Deion over Rob?
Hey, it's Hey, we said we were going to pick different guys. You picked Rod.
Yeah.
I got to go with Prime Time.
Okay, I did get the opportunity to pick first. Next week you're going to pick first when we do our next matchup.
I don't mind.
So,
hey, I don't mind. As LeBron says, I don't mind wearing the black hat. I'll wear the black hat. That's no problem. But you know, and again, when it comes to coverage, and this is honestly why I'm going. And I love Rob Woodson. I have his jersey. He's the first Steeler jersey I have. And when I would give away, which I'm really upset, I would have a LeVon Kirkland and Bettis jersey in my closet, which I now do not have, but I digress. You know, Rod was an amazing cornerback. As you said, Chris, he was big and he used his physicality.
Well,
but Deion was the Michael Jordan of guarding people.
Oh man, Michael Jordan of guarding people. What do people say about that? But let's get to our comments here on Twitter and on Behind the Steel Curtain in the comment section of the article, because we've been posting this question and we've had some responders. Our first responder was Empire of Steel on Twitter, and he said it's Rod Woodson simply because he played with more passion and he had better coaches. So I guess more passion, that's not something I can exactly measure. And I wouldn't say that Deion didn't have passion. The man invented a dance that people still do to this day when they score. But, okay, I hear you on that. Our next comment, which has started a bit of a back and forth here on Twitter, it was from Vino, or Depeche Recknor, I can't pronounce that right, but he said Woodson was better at tackling, but Deion was better at covering, which is what you're saying. He was better at covering. And in response, the legendary, the chief, Neil Coulomb, he commented and said the gap between the two was slim in coverage but massive in tackling. And he finished with the hashtag, Rod is God. And that goes to what I'm saying. You can say that Deion might have had a slight edge in coverage, but it wasn't all that much different. Rod has the third most interceptions of all time with 71. The most interceptions for touchdown with 12. There's that's where I think he comes into play with that. And then we had another person who came in and said Deion tackled no one ever, which is trying to suggest that he could tackle a little bit. But that's one of the knocks on Deion. He couldn't come up and make those big tackles. I mean, he had less than 500 tackles in a career that spanned from 87 to 2005.
Right,
granted,
but he wasn't paid to tackle people, though. I mean, it's almost like
true.
Pedro Alvarez. They're not asking Pedro to hit for average. They're asking Pedro to hit home runs. And,
yeah.
Right, and I think that's what people got to remember about Deion Sanders. Just again, playing devil's advocate here, you know. And that's what makes for good debate. Is that Deion wasn't paid to make tackles. No, and again, Deion wasn't as big as Rod. Deion played the percentages. He knew that if he went up to stop a Bam Morris was going to knock his block off. He would.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that's
so,
the,
yeah,
the,
that's,
you know,
that's just what I'm saying. People would say he was a bad tackler. Like, I'm honestly going to call some people out. You know, show me a link or a tape of Deion Sanders actually getting bulldozed. I mean, he wasn't that – I think sometimes it's kind of like Sammy Coates with his drops. I feel like a lot of times people just – they hear a rumor or they hear just a stereotype about a player, and then that's it the rest of his career. It's just kind of like, okay, well, somebody said Sammy Coates has questionable catching ability, so now that's going to be the M.O. And I feel like Deion wasn't the greatest tackler ever, but he wasn't
but
as bad as everybody
part
said
of what
he was,
saying.
You know.
It's also part of what you're saying. It might not have been necessarily him being bad. He was just – that's not his thing, and he didn't stick to it. And that's what Vino says in response to Mario. They're conversing back and forth on Twitter, and he said Deion made better, quote-unquote, business decisions. And it's one of those things. The NFL is a physical game. You want to preserve your body, and that might have been something that Deion was taking note of. He was like, I don't want to come up and hit Bam Morris. That's not my job. My job is to make sure that we don't get roasted by Yancey, Sigtan, Lewis, or whoever else. Ernie Mills and Cordell Stewart. My job is to keep those guys on lock. Let my front seven do that job. And while Rod you know, Rod played, had longevity, but he still came up and made those plays. So, yeah, Deion might not, it might not have been that Deion was the worst tackler ever, but he knew that wasn't his role. And you're right, he played to his role, and he's one of the greatest cover corners in the history of the game. I wouldn't call him Michael Jordan, but you know what? I might call him LeBron James, because I don't see LeBron James being as good as Jordan, but that's a whole other debate.
The other thing, too, is, Chris, and this isn't necessarily fair to Rod, but in Rod's heyday, he, you know, I mean, 93, he had 8 interceptions. You know, he was in his late 20s, and he was 28 at the time. So let's just call that Rod Woodson's heyday was 92 through 94 was his absolute heyday, which is funny because then he played another dozen years after that time span. But, you know, Rod was the best kick and part, one of the best kick and punt returners at the time. He was also the best cornerback at the time, but his teams were okay. They got one playoff win during that span. He was the best player on Blitzberg's defense. So when you look at his – and again, football is different than basketball and other sports where you can't totally look at a guy's team success and say, okay, well, that helps define your career. However, when you're comparing two players, that certainly doesn't hurt. And, yeah, I know Deion had a lot more talent. He had Steve Young and Trey Aikman as quarterbacks, and Rod Woodson didn't. He had Neil O'Donnell and Bobby Brister during that time.
Mm-hmm.
But Deion was the best player on 2 years in a row on teams that won Super Bowls. He was the best player. I mean, 94, he was the NFL Defensive Player of the Year. And really, you know, on a team that had Jerry Rice, that had Steve Young, that had Ken Norton Jr., that had Ricky Waters, it was Deion Sanders that people look back and say he was the difference in helping them win a Super Bowl. Then the very next year, he joins Dallas, and they won the Super Bowl. And mm-hmm.
I'm hearing what you're saying.
Right. So, you know, so for me, it's like his heyday, he was not only the best player on the best team, but he was the best – he was the best player on his team on Super Bowls. He was also the best player in his division. And, you know, the thing about Deion was, I remember reading an article in SI, and Andre Rison talked about when he would face Deion. And Andre Rison, you know, he doesn't stand up now. His career doesn't stand the test of time. People don't really remember him. But he was, for a short time, one of the premier receivers in the NFL. And he said, playing against Deion once, Deion would talk to him during the game and say, like, all right, I know you're going to run this. When you run this, here's what's going to happen. And then he started to play with Andre, saying to him, like, hey, I'll give you this quick pass, or I'll let you do this on me. I'll give you this little bit of a cushion. And then Rison got shut down, and he was just in awe the whole time of Deion. Rod, he goes down as it's almost like if you're going to go look at basketball, like his ability to cover was like Dwayne Wade. He was just unbelievable for his time. But Deion's coverage was kind of like Mel Blunt, like all-time greats. And what I want to ask you is, as we're going to go over here, which is okay, if you can follow the rest of this podcast tomorrow once it's released on iTunes. If you're listening live, you won't catch the end of this. But and really, at the end of the day, Chris went with Rod and I went with Deion. So if you're gonna, we're going to cut it there. But I guess, too, it comes down to what's more important to you when you look at the intangibles is – mm-hmm. Rod Woodson's ability on special teams or Deion's ability as a receiver, which one was more valuable to his team?
And that's also to be considered. And just so we can get into people who commented on behind the steel curtains under the article, we had Blackadar who said that Woodson would be over Sanders because of it significantly being better. And he said, quote, unquote, everything else other than coverage, which I'm not sure, you know, there's an everything else to that. We got Tom Crawford who said Rod was a better player, a better defensive player, and isn't even close. That includes coverage. And remember, we are Steelers fans, so naturally a lot of us are going to see it that way. But it's the one. And then Bozillo 6 says, depends. Deion was a better corner. Rod was a better football player. Rod got burned way more than Deion, but he also had more sacks and more big tackles. So it's really sort of like you're saying, you know, pick what you want. Pick what strength would you rather have? Would you rather have a guy that runs up and makes the big play and can cover, or the guy who's just elite at covering and knows not to put himself in situations where he's not at his strength?
Right. But to me, it comes down to, again, if I'm going with Deion Sanders, I'm going with the fact that he could change the game in two ways. And you remember that Super Bowl against us? He shut down Yancey Thigpen pretty much that whole game. Yancey had that one touchdown. Well, really, Deion actually committed pass interference, but they didn't call. He shoved Yancey when Yancey was making that catch. But he guarded Yancey the entire game, Yancey had 3 catches for 19 yards. That's a guy that had nearly 1,400 yards that year and 80-plus catches. So, you know, Deion shut him down, and on the other side beat Willie Williams, who had 7 picks that year. He beat him for a 47-yard catch. So Deion made an impact with Super Bowl 30 on both ends of the field. And also, when Neil O'Donnell threw those 2 horrendous interceptions to Larry Brown, well, guess what? He wasn't throwing Deion's way. So when you listen to Dallas and their American team, what they did in that game was they would blitz a lot to whatever side Deion wasn't on because they knew that Neil O'Donnell in crunch time wasn't going to throw Deion's way. So those plays, they brought a blitz right in Neil O'Donnell's face. Neil would rather pretty much – they knew Neil would rather take a chance on a blitz on the strong side rather than not have a blitz and have to face Deion one-on-one in crunch time. And that's the biggest difference with Deion was teams designed their whole defense around him. So, yeah, while that pass was really dumb on Neil's part, he would rather throw a blind pass towards the sidelines than try to challenge Deion Sanders. That's the impact that Deion had in his prime, and his prime lasted from like 89 to 2000, which was that in crunch time, the opposing quarterback never wanted to throw his way, and he truly did take away half the football field, taking absolutely nothing away from Rod Woodson. And suffice to say that in my mind, Rod Woodson had one of the most courageous comeback stories in NFL history after he tore his MCL and ACL trying to tackle Barry Sanders in week 1 of the 95 season, came back and played in that Super Bowl and held Michael Irvin to 76 receiving yards. And, you know, Michael averaged over 100 per game that regular season, and he held him to really only really one meaningful catch in that game, which was after Larry Brown's first interception. So really, you got to give Rod all the credit in the world for that. But it's a great debate, and it's two players that were different, but both had an extreme impact. And I think what you know, to me, what defined Deion Sanders' career was the wow, the big plays that he could provide for you. And that led to Super Bowl wins for his teams in his prime. When I think about Rod Woodson, I just think about a great athlete, just a great thoroughbred athlete that got the most out of his athletic tools and did it for a long time and did it at a high level for a long time. It sucks that he won a Super Bowl for the Ravens, but that was the only good thing that came out of that Super Bowl was that it validated Rod Woodson's career as a guy that won a Super Bowl, still playing at a high level, but really, either way, I mean, you can't go wrong with either guy.
And something else that also rings true in my heart for Rod Woodson, if there was a segment on NFL Network, and you should go back and look it up if you're listening right now, it was a discussion with Antonio Cromartie, Rod Woodson, and Warren Sapp, and then a moderator from NFL Network, and it was who was the best single-season defense of all time. And as soon as the discussion starts, Rod Woodson asks, "Is this so? Wait, we can only choose based off of one season, or can we choose off of how great a defense was over a long period of time?" And so, of course, in the discussion are Warren Sapp Buccaneers that won the Super Bowl in 2003, and then also the 2000 Ravens, but also the 76 Steelers were up in there. So, you know, when asked, you know, of each player, Warren Sapp, of course, said his Buccaneers, but he said if there was a number 2, it would be the 2000 Ravens. And so him and Cromartie both agreed on that, and they asked Rod, "Don't you think that the team that you played on was the greatest defense that ever lived?" And he said, "No, I'm sticking with the Steelers." He said, "Mel Blount is the greatest corner that's ever played the game of football." And that's with Rod being a corner. He's saying that another Steeler, who a predecessor to his job, was better than him. And he has always shown the Steelers loyalty at every turn, and that's with going playing for arch nemesis, the Ravens and the Raiders. You know, he's played for other teams, but Rod Woodson's love for Pittsburgh still rings true, and that's another reason why I'm like, that's one of my favorite players ever, because when he stood up and said that, both Warren Sapp and Antonio Cromartie, "How could you say that?" He's like, "Hey, I speak the truth. The Steelers won 4 Super Bowls. Each of these other units, they only won 1. So, and it was based off of that great Steelers defense. So if I was so that's another reason why, if you're a Steelers fan, check it out. It should still be on in the NFL archives. It was a nice little conversation, but Rod caught everyone off guard. Did not say it was the Ravens team that he played on, but a Steelers team that was before his time.
That's awesome. I didn't know that. That's very cool. And that's one thing that Rod is a true Steeler. You know, he finished his career on other teams, and he was a Pittsburgh Steeler. And it wasn't that Rod wanted to leave. He really didn't. That was the Steelers' decision. He got hurt in 95, came back and made the Pro Bowl the next year, and had six interceptions. But he got burned a few times because, you know, he was 31 years old coming off an injury that normally – I mean, when you tear your ACL, MCL, especially 20 years ago, you were never the same player. If you even came back and you could gut out a few more seats. Like, look at Greg Lloyd, 96. He suffered an injury, albeit it wasn't the injury that Rod suffered. He was never the same player. I mean, when you're at that high of a level and you suffer an injury to one of your major body parts, your arms, your knees, your legs, you know, your shins, you're risking the chance of never coming back near the same level. And so, you know, yeah – Was Rod the same Rod 96? No, but the guy still had six picks and made the Pro Bowl. He was a big part of that team. And that team also wasn't as good defensively because Greg Lloyd was injured. They also didn't have Kevin Green. And, yeah, Chad Brown and Willie ended up becoming good players. At the beginning of the season, you know, teams tested Rod, and Rod had to make up for a lot of his insufficiencies surrounding him on defense. And that's the one thing about Rod Woodson that I wish was different is that Deion had that defining moment in his career where, you know, the stars kind of aligned and the best teams pick him to be on their team, and he shined on the biggest stages. It's a shame that Rod didn't have that. Now, Rod ended up winning a Super Bowl with the Ravens, and he ended up playing another one for the Raiders, and he did play in Super Bowl 30 for us. Which I think I think if you would ask Rod, hey, what's your defining moment? It's probably overcoming those injuries to play in Super Bowl 30 and play as well as he did. And I just wish Rod would have had a defining moment in the Steelers jersey. Like, gosh, how many does Troy have? The pick against the Ravens in 08.
Right.
Or fumble against the Ravens in 2010. He has so many of those defining moments. I just wish Rod had one or two in his career so that going, you know, now years later for people that didn't watch him play, they can show him a play and they say, okay, well, that's Rod Woodson being Rod Woodson. He has plenty of those. And if you watched him play, you remember him. But if you don't, they're hard to find because they didn't happen. His teams didn't get there, and when they got there, it didn't happen. And that's the one thing that when you look back at history, you'll go, oh, Deion was the best because he did this, he did that. But you also have to look at the guys that he played against. You know, Rod didn't always have, you know, the best offenses that would give him a break like Deion Sanders did. Deion did a good job with the Falcons in the 90s. That's another reason why I give Deion some credit there too. Him and Rod kind of had the same start to their careers. They were on not very good teams, and they really helped speed up the maturation processes of those bunches. You know, when Rod was drafted in 87 along with Greg Lloyd later, you know, they pretty much, you know, got things started for the last, you know, of Chuck Knoll's teams leading into Bill Cowher's teams. They brought the workmanlike attitude. They brought the tenacity of the 70s Steelers had. That's something that Deion had to do with Atlanta. They weren't very good, but he brought the attitude, he brought the swagger, and then, you know, Atlanta had a good run in the early 90s. They didn't win any Super Bowls, but they were certainly a good team. So, yeah, lots to discuss on this. I'll let you have the last words on the debate here, Chris, between Rod Woodson and Deion Sanders.
Well, I think we've both done a great job covering things, and I thank for those who contributed on Twitter with the live feed and on BTSC's website in the comments section. It was a very good discussion we had today. It's true. Deion contributed twice in the key moments of his prime to Super Bowl teams. And that often, that gets you a nod from me. But when you're talking about nods, I'm going to have to give mine to Rod because of how great of a player he was, the different things that he brought to the game. And that's what I would want. But I totally hear your side. It's one of those great discussions. There's never going to be a right answer for truth or fiction. But when you're talking about one of these things, it's just who do you want? And I think that we had a good discussion here today. And those who joined us, hopefully that you got to think about some of their great moments and great achievements in their careers and enjoyed the conversation as well. So we will come up with another matchup, a big matchup next week, featuring another legendary Steeler and a legendary NFL player. If you're listening on iTunes right now, tweet at us at VT Steel Curtain on Twitter and say who you want to see. You want to see
you know, legendary linebacker matchup, a running back matchup, quarterback, you know, whatever you want to see, let us know.
Right, and thanks again to Chris for coming up with this idea. I think it's great. I think it's a great addition to our show, especially here in the off season where there's always news to discuss on what's hot, but it's always good to just have this time to talk about the heritage of the Steelers and the NFL. And, you know, to our listeners that listen in, more so than just, you know, who's right and who's wrong, because really this is opinions. There's really no right and wrong here. We
right.
hope that maybe we can open up your minds to the discussion in terms of educating our listeners about all the great players and kind of giving you an idea of who you would pick. Obviously, this being a Steeler podcast, you're going to normally go with the Steeler, but I think it's always good to at least think about the other side, and this will hopefully educate listeners that didn't see either of these guys play. Oh, man, I didn't know that Rod Woodson could do this, or the Unfinished could do that, or the X Factor. So hopefully it broadens your horizons. And, again, you know, we'll encourage you to call in on future shows, or, again, as Chris, you know, rattled off and read online some of the guys that respond on Twitter and our BTSC article, please, you know, share with us your thoughts and opinions because they are always valued. And last thing, Chris, we did it last week, we'll do it this week. What's the finals going to be next time we talk? They play Thursday and they play Sunday and Tuesday. So there will be three more games in the books by the next time we talk. What's the series going to be at that point?
Man, if there's three more games in the books, means I'm going to have to say if we're talking about going to game seven, it's going to be a game seven. It ain't going to end in six. I don't think that the Warriors are going to back down. I think Steve Kerr's got some crafty things cooking up in his kitchen, and Chef Curry with the pot is going to be cooking up some crazy shots, and that's going to inspire his team. I think Clay's going to get back in it. I think Green's going to be more impactful. And I think that the Cavs, they've done a great job. But you know what? You know, you can play great for a few games, but can you keep it going? I know LeBron can, but let's see how the supporting cast. But I got over the next three games, the Warriors will do the 2-1 that I said they do last week, and they'll even it up, and we'll have a game seven for the ages coming next week.
I think I hope you're right, just from the standpoint that I don't want to see basketball season end, because that means just baseball until football starts. But really, there's always news with football, as the show is titled, What's Hot, to give you guys that kind of coverage. But I think it's going to be over. I think the Cavs win it in five. I think you know, the Warriors, you know, they can't figure out the Cavs' defense. I think mentally, I don't think they can – they don't think they can beat LeBron. He's kind of at that Jordan mythological – he's got the Jordan mythological advantage where people see him lined up and they don't think they can beat him. And, you know, at this point, it's a best of four, and you've got to beat him three times before he beats you twice. I just don't think it's in the cards for him. Again, I think Golden State's a very good team, but I just think that the Cavs have too many things going in their favor right now. And that is extremely biased, and so I'm not going to hide that. Just like you, Chris, said that it was biased when you picked Rod. But I know that you also know that he probably could have been better than Deion Sanders. So, and again, that's something that we hope you guys continue to look forward to is select a Steeler, and based on your comments, you know, that might sway where we go in terms of what comparison we're going to bring to the table next week. But unfortunately, that's all the time we have for this show. It always goes by fast, and I know I enjoyed doing it with you, Chris, and looking forward to next week's show already, and we'll have another select a Steeler for you as long as all the other news and notes regarding the Steelers as we march every day is one day closer, 92 days away from the start of the 2015 NFL season. And once again, if you want to follow this show during the week on our podcast, go to iTunes under the podcast segment, write The Standard is a Standard, and you'll see our show titled What's Hot to Listen. So for Chris Carter, this has been Brian Diarra signing off, saying so long for this show. And as always, it's a great day to be a Steelers fan.